It's Karen Conti, The Karen Conti Show. Thank you for tuning in. It's a crummy night, and there are other things going on, I've been told. I'm not quite sure exactly what that might be. But I just want to let you know that if you're not watching the Super Bowl, think how lucky you really are. If you're listening to my show and you're not watching the Super Bowl, first of all, the average person on Super Bowl eats 6,000 calories by the end of the day, which, to my calculations, means that you would have to run a marathon in order to burn off all those calories. So I saved you a marathon and or 6,000 calories. The average person spends $81.17 on the Super Bowl, and that includes food and booze and decorations and things like that. So I saved you $81.17 plus the 6,000 calories. And that doesn't even include the betting, because apparently it's up to $5 billion in for the Super Bowl, which is just staggering. 97% of it is illegal. So basically, we also know that about 1 in 10 people will call in sick tomorrow, 1 in 13, I think, roughly. And so I'm also saving you some truancy. But it's an interesting time because the U.S. Supreme Court is considering this summer a case that if they decided in favor of betting, might make all Super Bowl betting and all sports betting legal. I'm not sure how it's going to come down, but it involves a New Jersey law regarding some of this online betting that is going on, and they're trying to argue that the federal law, which makes betting for sports illegal, they're saying that that's unconstitutional. So maybe next year we're going to have all betting that's legal. I want to talk a little bit about the Larry Nassar case, and this is that case, of course, of the Michigan State doctor who I believe now the toll is up to about 260 women who are complaining that he sexually abused them. Horrific. More of the sentencing went on this week, and one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the father of three girls who said they were sexually abused by him, had a little episode in court where he had some words and he said that he wanted to be granted 5 minutes with the perpetrator, and the judge said, no, that's not the way we do things, and he said maybe a minute, and then he lunged at the perpetrator. You know, we've seen this in courtrooms before. As a practicing lawyer, I see it all the time, not just in criminal courts, but in civil courts, which I use that term loosely, where emotions are high. Maybe it's a family law divorce case or a case where two business partners, I remember I was in a courtroom where they attacked each other. So you see this all the time, and it really presents a very dangerous thing, because you have the sheriffs who are there, the bailiffs, and they have guns. And you never want a gun to come out in a courtroom because, as you know, it's a very confined area and people can get hurt. And it's just not the thing to do. Obviously, the man had a lot of support. He came out and apologized. I think he handled it well afterwards. But one of the things that this brought to mind is the issue of Nassar going to jail. And most people say, I don't care what happens, he will rot in jail. But let me just talk a little bit about my experience in the prison system. I have done criminal defense work at different points in my life. I have gone to probably every prison in Illinois at least once, and some prisons in other states. So there's an interesting code of conduct in the prisons when it comes to sexual predators. And they don't do well. They actually have a nickname called CHOMOs, child molesters. And they don't do well. And it's interesting because you would think if someone committed murder, why are they taking the high road against a child molester? And there's many reasons. You know, even for people who commit murder, they look down upon the idea that someone's doing something to a child. And a lot of these men who are in jail have children themselves, and even though maybe they murdered someone or they did something very, very bad, they don't like the fact that their child could have been subject to that kind of thing, so they take it personally. The other thing that is very interesting is that Many of the prisoners themselves have been sexually abused or abused as children. The statistics are very high that people who commit these heinous crimes who are going to be in these bad prisons, we'll call them, have been abused themselves, and so they don't take kindly to pedophiles. So when you put all of those facts together, you have a very dangerous situation. And again, you can say, I don't care what happens to Larry Nassar, which I'm sure all of you are saying, but the prison has an obligation to keep its prisoners safe. And if they don't, they get sued. And it's very expensive. And it can also be very dangerous because if a bailiff has to break up a fight and a sheriff has to come with a gun loaded, that it presents a very, very dangerous situation. And what we have now, interestingly, are certain prisons and certain areas in prisons where they have just housed sexual offenders. So they keep them together with the idea that if they're all sexual predators, then at least there's no hierarchy there and less violence and less activity. In fact, what's interesting is that Nassar pled guilty first to child pornography charges in federal court, and he got 60 years there, which probably means he will serve out all of his time in a federal prison rather than a state prison, which is probably better for him, and it may have been a strategic move on behalf of his defense lawyers if they had control of that. And in the federal prisons, they have a certain area called the Sex Offender Management Program, SOMP, and they put the sex offenders in those areas. And so, just because Nassar is from Michigan, he probably won't be in Michigan. He'll probably go somewhere else in the country. And even Marion, Illinois, which is a downstate federal prison, has one of those kinds of facilities down there. And so it'll be interesting to see where he goes. You know, and these people, you know, it's punishment. If anyone thinks that prison isn't punishment, it's punishment. Gacy, when he was incarcerated in Menard, was attacked. As we know, Jeffrey Dahmer was murdered in prison. Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler, was killed in prison. John Gogan, who was the Catholic priest who was convicted of abusing about 130 boys, was also murdered in prison. So he doesn't have an easy road of it, and I think that most people would say that's what he deserves, but I wanted to fill you in a little bit about my experience in that prison system. I want to talk, we're going to be taking your legal calls at 8 o'clock. I want to give you that number right now, 312-981-7200, and those are going to be calls about legal issues you might have. If you have questions or comments about legal news that you've heard about during the week and you want to ask me my opinion, I'm certainly happy to give that to you. So it's 981-7200, and you can also text to that number. But before we go, I just want to quickly say that it's about 10 years since the smoking ban in Illinois. Wow. And lawmakers are now wanting to raise the age for tobacco sales from 18 years old to 21 years old. The statistics are amazing. 10% of high school students say they use tobacco in the last 30 days. If the rates stay the same as they are now, one out of 13 Americans who are under the age of 17 will eventually die from smoke-related problems. One out of 13, if things continue. So this is a serious problem, and the Illinois government is trying to figure out whether or not they're going to raise the age to purchase tobacco to 21. Here's my challenge to you. If anybody has a good reason why we shouldn't raise the age to 21, call me and tell me. Don't call me if you think it's a good idea, because it is a good idea, I think. I just want to hear the other side of it. I want to hear why we should not raise the age to purchase tobacco to 21. 312-981-7200. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. It's Karen Conti on the Karen Conti Show. There is a segment here where I talk a little bit about what I call presumed ignorant. And these are the stupid criminals, the clumsy crooks who get in trouble by doing really stupid things. And, you know, I've noticed a little bit of a trend when it comes to crooks who do things when it comes to food. I'm thinking that last week we had two criminals who one of them got into a fight with someone over the quality of food. And then the second one got into a fight over a slice of cheesecake. So this week, on Presumed Ignorant, we have an ice cream man from Middlesex, England, who is in jail for attacking a rival with a shovel for encroaching on his turf. The victim was really pretty badly injured and underwent surgery. No good humor here. The second one is a Waffle House customer, and I'm not sure that anything good ever happened at a Waffle House, either while you're eating there or after. But the guy's eating there, Bibb County, Georgia, I'm not kidding, and he's eating and he asked for barbecue sauce, and they apparently didn't have any barbecue sauce, which led him to start screaming obscenities and insulting the staff, and a scuffle ensued, and he was charged with disorderly conduct. So those are my two presumed ignorant tonight. And one of the things that I saw in the news today was there were actually two stories about funeral homes. And my friend Eric the Undertaker, one of my favorite people in the world, who's a big fan and a listener of WGN, is going to join us to talk about those two news stories. Let me preface the story here. This is a New Berlin, Wisconsin funeral home is hosting a pizza and pre-plan event on February 20th. It's what you do is they're offering free pizza for anyone who comes into the funeral home to plan their funeral. So that's their enticement to do that. And very interesting. Talking about taking you out in a box. So the other story that I thought was interesting was it came out of England, where someone placed a coconut in a coffin. And what happened was when they put the coconut in the coffin, it went through the crematorium, and of course it exploded, which caused problems all over. And one of the things that the article was talking about was that people like to put different things in a casket. They like to put maybe belongings for the person that meant something of them, you know, phones, cigarettes, bottles of alcohol, items of clothing. So these kinds of things cause serious problems because, of course, those things don't go through the crematorium very well. Eric, are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. So let's start with the first story. Eric, first of all, I call you Eric the Undertaker, but you're a funeral director. Is that technically
yes,
what you
are? I'm a licensed funeral director in the state of Illinois.
Okay. Let's start with the first story about this funeral home that tried to get people in by giving them free pizza. People don't like to plan their demise, do they?
And not really. And it's unfortunate because prearrangements, what we call in the industry, the making of prearrangements is one of the wisest and smartest things a person can do for a couple of reasons. One, it avoids any misunderstandings amongst family members who are survivors. And number two, a person has the option of prepaying over a number of years, and they can be locked in at today's funeral costs rather than what they would cost 20 years from now.
Eric, so, it's interesting that this, about 3 days ago, a WGN caller actually texted me and said he had an issue because a family member wanted to be buried someplace, and then the new wife wanted him to be buried somewhere else, and he died without a plan. He didn't have a will or a trust, and he asked me whose wishes won. Would have been his wishes that he orally said to the family, or would it be what his new wife wanted, where his new wife wanted to bury him? And as you probably know, and I know, that the law dictates that if there's an executor or a trustee or a document signed saying, here's who I want to make the decision, or here's where I want my body buried, you go to the next of kin, which would be the spouse, correct?
That's very correct. It's the surviving spouse has what we call the right to control the funeral, and that can get very, very sticky, so to speak, and it can cause a lot of animosity. I've seen it firsthand when making funeral arrangements, and it's usually the larger the family is that, you know, comes in to make arrangements, the more difficult it is. And I did have a cremation case a number of years ago where the person came in to make arrangements, and I got halfway through, you know, my paperwork, and he said, oh, by the way, this person has a daughter who he hasn't seen, he's been estranged from, and it's like, uh-oh, wait a second. You know, and she was, you know, out in Texas or Arizona or someplace, and the death occurred in Illinois. He said, well, I'm here to make the arrangements. I said, unfortunately, it's not that simple, because if he has a surviving, you know, a daughter, she's next of kin. So I had to contact her and get an affidavit saying that she was turning over all her authority to the person making the arrangements. And then that, you know, helped me naturally because, you know, I have, you know, my ethical responsibility, my legal responsibilities too, to make sure that, whoever is taking responsibility has the right to do so.
And sometimes I see where the children might be the next of kin and the children are at odds as to where the body should go.
And that's exactly it. And that's very important, especially with cremation. I'm in my office right now and I brought out my 3 pages of cremation authorization paperwork, which has 6,000 calories of pizza sauce on them already from watching the game. But at any rate, the law states that if a person has not specified through the Illinois Disposition of Remains Act, and we can talk about that in a second, or you can talk about it. If there are, say, for example, 5 children, and they all have equal right of disposition, say it's a parent that passed away, the children are the ones legally entitled to making the arrangements, and 4 out of those 5 children are in favor of cremation, but the 5th one says, no, I don't want mom or dad to be cremated. The cremation cannot take place without a court order. So that's when it gets very, very difficult. And then you try and, you know, reason with people, and finally I tell them, I say, you know, I can't do this unless you're all in agreement.
And the bottom line is that this is, you know, another layer, Eric, of what I say all the time to people. Get an estate plan. It doesn't matter if you have a lot. It doesn't matter if you have a little. It makes sense to put this in writing and to spend a little money on a lawyer who can do this for you so you don't have these horrendous types of disputes at a time where everyone is grieving. And I've seen it myself where someone is laid out in a funeral home and no one can decide where the body's going to go. And it's
right.
Very disturbing and it's very emotional and it can be put to rest very easily by filling out forms. And there are forms online in Illinois where you can actually just tell everybody where you want to be buried or if you want to be cremated and you sign it. And I believe there's a notary available. Even if you don't have a estate plan or a will or a trust, at least do that so you know where you're going to be and that people are not going to fight about it.
Right.
Quickly, Eric, I want to get to this other story, which is kind of funny sounding, but the coconut gets put into the coffin and eventually the thing goes through the crematorium and it explodes and it causes all kinds of problems and frightens everyone. I understand now that this is a common thing, that people will try to put personal items into a casket or coffin. Have you seen this happen and does this cause problems?
Yes, I've seen it firsthand. It's not a problem, obviously, if it's an earth burial, but there are situations where a person is ultimately destined for the crematory, and certain family members say, "Oh, I want to slip, his favorite whatever," and into his casket. And the thing is, the crematory does not open the casket for inspection purposes. Once the person arrives at the crematory, they're destined for the actual furnace. And on my cremation paperwork that I spoke of earlier, I've got 3 separate paragraphs on disclosure of mechanical devices, implants, or prior treatment of the deceased with radioactive material. And it was mainly for things like pacemakers or body parts, artificial body parts that could be explosive, because, you know, the crematory goes up to about 2,500 degrees.
Which sounds kind of nice right now.
yeah, on a day like today, sure.
So you just have to be careful because you need to make sure that there's no problems in the whole process. But
right.
It's all very interesting.
I have the family, you know, disclose if there are any implants or anything that could be dangerous. So Okay. If somebody flips something into a casket that could be potentially dangerous, then it can cause literally an explosion. And if, you know, if the cemetery worker is, you know, opening up the furnace door, you know, for inspection, and all of a sudden there's an explosion, you know, he could be injured at the very least.
Eric, thank you for joining us so much. If people want to get a hold of you, Eric the Undertaker, do you have a phone number or email address quickly?
Yes, Hoffman, F-D, H-O-F-F-M-A-N-N-F-D.
Thank you.
AOL.com.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year and Happy Super Bowl. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Stormy weather sends my man and I together. Keeps raining all the time.
Well, Monday is National Weatherman's Day. I bet you didn't know that. We do know that the groundhog came out this week, and we're going to have six more weeks of winter, which to me sounds like a good deal, because it seems to me that it's going to last forever and ever and ever. But with us to talk about National Weatherman's Day is my favorite weatherman and meteorologist on air at Fox TV in Chicago. He's done the weather for many, many years on camera, from the coast of Oregon to New York. He's a native of Ottawa and one of the nicest guys ever in the news. Hi, Mark. Thank you for joining me.
No way. I'm your favorite. Out of all the weather people you know in the entire universe, I'm your favorite.
You are. You're just
wow,
so nice.
That is an honor.
And even when you're giving me really bad weather, you just do it in such a jovial way that I just don't mind walking out in the slush. But I want to say Happy Weatherman's Day to you, but
You have said,
I have read online that you say you're not a weatherman, you're a meteorologist. What is the difference? What is the difference?
Well, you know, I mean, if you want to practice law in Louisiana, you don't need to go to law school, right?
You just have to know the Napoleonic Code and what not to do at
Mardi Gras. You don't have to go to law school. So are you really an attorney if you don't go to law school? So I went to weatherman school. What a concept.
So you learn about it. Instead of just being an on-air personality that reads the weather, you actually know what you're looking at and what you're talking about.
Instead of just, you know, an average weather guesser, I actually am a trained weather guesser.
Okay.
So, you know, I've got a degree in everything. It's amazing.
What do you study in college? What is meteorology? What exactly?
Meteorology. You know, you basically study science. You know, I started, I had kind of a weird story. You know, when I was in second grade, we used to hang out behind my grandmother's house and find these cool fossils back in this little kind of a mine area. You know, it was kind of a place where the earth had been disturbed. So we'd come back with these like little tin cans full of fossils. So I remember going to, you know, show and tell like second, third grade going, oh, I want to be an archaeologist. Well, that year the teacher was like, hey, you dumb kid, that's not an archaeologist, that's a geologist. So I'm like, okay, well, I want to be a geologist. And then the very next year, it was about fourth grade, Harry Volkman came to our church, spoke at our father-son banquet, and at that very moment, I decided I wanted to become a meteorologist. I left the fossils in the can and thought that would be the coolest job in the entire universe. Met Harry, nicest guy in the entire world. Of course, Harry did weather in Chicago forever. And when Harry retired from Fox 32, I took over for him.
Now, what do you think it takes to be a good weatherman? What are the qualities?
You know, I think that, first of all, you have to have a basic understanding of weather. You know, that's just to kind of get your, you know, off the starting line. But, you know, not only do you have to understand it, you have to be able to explain it clearly so that people understand. I mean, weather is kind of a complex, three-dimensional thing that happens all the time that doesn't always follow all the rules that we think it should follow. So the weather's changing. It doesn't always fit the pattern or the forecast. So I think you need to explain it as best as you can. And I think also you need to explain kind of the limits of, okay, here's what's going to happen, but it could be between, you know, this area on the left and this area on the right. So there's a little bit of a range. So you need to know, especially folks that are working outside, they need to know what not only what the weather forecast is going to be, but what could go wrong and, you know, how far either way could go.
If you have any questions for Mark Strell, the weatherman, the meteorologist from Fox TV, give us a call here, 312-981-7200, 981-7200, or text to that number. I guess I think there are two different kinds of people, Mark. There are people who look at the weather before they leave the house, and some people just take their chances and run out. And I'm probably the latter. I mean, I'm always without the umbrella. I'm the one without the hat, no gloves, you know. And you know, but then there are some people that just love the weather, and they look at it, and they have it on their phone, which I guess brings me to the topic of, at some point, is this going to be an obsolete job, in that we get it on our phone, we get it on the internet, you know, we get it on Alexa. Is this something that's going to, we're going to need in television in the future?
Don't tell anybody that. Don't tell. You know, it's funny. You can already find out so much information that's on the internet. You can also get like every app known to man that will give you weather, and it's all for free. And there are still weather people around. Weather is the most watched segment of a television newscast.
Really?
So yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. I'm surprised.
Sports or something would be. Yeah, yeah, but weather is the most watched segment. And one of the reasons is we're looking for clarity. We're looking for a little bit of analysis. So, you know, we can all look at our phone. And, of course, we all do look at our phones, and we see the suns or the clouds or the rains or the lightning bolts. But really, we want to know, again, you know, what's the story behind the story? What's the story behind that icon? Is something going to change during the day? Is something going to... you know, I mean, be out of the ordinary. I mean, and also, that's where there's a little bit of room for personality. There's a little room for entertainment there as well. So, I mean, if we can get our information and maybe be informed or educated or cajoled or, you know, I mean, just learn something new, that's a bonus.
True or false, pink sky at night, sailor's delight, pink sky in the morning, sailors take warning. True or false?
Well, the one I go with is red sky. But,
okay.
You know, red, pink, those are pretty close to one another. You know, I've got books that are full of weather folklore. And, you know, back before the weather, you know, forecasting business was, you know, weather forecasting was very well understood. We had all kinds of, you know, folklore sayings. Most of them are not very accurate. That one, however, is probably one of the more accurate sayings. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky in the morning, sailor take warning. You know, I don't know exactly how accurate it is, but I'd say probably 60, 70, 75% accurate.
Can you explain why it is? Because I've noticed that it does seem fairly accurate. If you've got that sky in the morning, there's going to be precipitation or something bad happening.
Yeah, okay. Pretend you're downtown Chicago. You're looking out over the lake. You're looking off towards Michigan, towards Indiana.
Yes.
You see a red sky over there. That means it's not completely cloudy. The sun's coming up in the morning. The sun's still kind of coming through. It's not an orange, clear, blue sky, but it's kind of red or pink, like you say. So what you're seeing is the leading edge of that cloud cover, leading edge of a storm that's already beyond overhead. It's already moved to your east. So you're seeing the leading edge of a frontal system or a storm that's already heading over towards Michigan, towards India. Now, the worst of the storm might be back into Iowa. So you're starting to see that progression. So red sky in the morning, you know, the storms are kind of coming our way. The exact opposite is true at night. You're looking out towards, you know, maybe you're standing at on the sky deck and you're looking out towards O'Hare. You're looking out towards the western suburbs, and it's been cloudy all day. Now all of a sudden you see that red sky at night. Again, it's indicating that the cloud deck is breaking a little bit, and you're starting to see some sunshine through there, and things are starting to improve.
Weather 101. Before we go, I have to ask you, what's this green screen? Now, you're pointing to things that don't exist. Is that what's happening? You've got a blank screen. And I've been on Fox with you when I've been commenting on legal issues, and I watch you point to things, and there's nothing on the screen. How does that work? Is that hard to do?
That's the story of my life. You know, I tell people, I stand in front of a big green screen and point at stuff that's not really there. That
sounds like Wizard of Oz or something, yeah.
You know, it's funny, too. So we stand in front of this big green screen. You know, you've seen it 100 times. If you've ever watched any, you know, Disney show or a lot of shows, you'll see the green screen that is used. And basically, we just use that to help us with our weather graphics. So we could actually stand in front of a map. But then we'd have to swap out the maps. We'd have to physically move them. Now, with the green screen, the camera sees the green, and it automatically replaces the green in the camera with whatever my graphic is. So if I have a satellite map, it takes everything that's green, replaces a satellite image, And then I can control the graphics, you know, basically using a garage door opener. So I can step through my show with a garage door opener, click through and show you maybe 15 or 20 different maps, and kind of show you what the weather's going to be. Now, the reason why it's green, and it's, you've seen the green, it's kind of like this lime, fluorescent,
right,
awful green, it's because nobody wears clothes that color. So that's why they pick green. They can actually use any shade of any color that they want, but the green is something that nobody really, you know, the lime green leisure suits went out in the 70s, right?
Thank God for that. One last question,
yeah.
Okay, if we're playing rock, cup, paper, scissors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we go with the groundhog or do we go with Mark Strell?
It's funny. One time I said, this was a different television market. I said, I love the groundhog. I think they're really nice barbecued. And I people ask me, do you ever get hate mail, like when the weather's, you know, wrong or anything? I literally in like almost 30 years, I've never gotten any hate mail about blowing a forecast. But when I said that about a groundhog being barbecued, I got two letters, and they were the nastiest, vicious letters. One was from a 6-year-old girl who said that I was like an incredible monster, that why would I want to eat a furry little creature like that that's so cute? And one was from like a retirement home from some lady who said I was a nasty creature, and why would I want to eat a good barbecue, a cute little
well,
furry creature
they
like
eat
that.
Those kinds of foods in all different countries. I know, and I just got back from South America, and they eat cooey, which is guinea pig, so that's not far, not far off. Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Happy Weatherman's Day, and I'll see you at 5.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for joining us.
It's always great to talk to you, my friend.
That was Mark Strell, and we're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Karen Conti Show. We are talking, getting ready to talk law. At 8 o'clock, I'll be taking your calls. So if you have a question about divorce or about criminal law, about contracts, small claims court, I'll try to answer your questions or lead you in the right direction. That number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, or you can text me there. And I got a really nice text from Paul who says, Friday was the 2nd of February, and you know what that means. On that day, we should all eat some pork sausage because it's groundhog. Oh. He's got a cute picture of the groundhog here, though. Anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about the story that Brian brought up, and great minds think alike, I guess, but there was a Terre Haute, Indiana man who was arrested for giving the finger to a police officer. Apparently, the police officer had stopped another driver, and this guy was driving by and just flipped off the cop to be funny. He was then arrested, and he was charged with a statute that said that he was inciting some kind of violence. Well, the ACLU took up his cause and brought a lawsuit in order to throw that ticket out, saying that him, by the guy flipping off the cop, that was what we call free expression, which is a tangent of free speech. So the question is, it's a funny case, of course, and the whole, first of all, I want to say this. I would not recommend flipping off a police officer. There's nothing good that comes from that. And even if you have a legal right to do that, that doesn't mean you should do it, because these guys are out there and they're going to get angry, and they might take it out on you. And if you have the ACLU behind you, that's wonderful. But in the interim, you might be jailed, and you might be fined, and it might be a big problem. So I would probably refrain from doing that. That said, the question is, does our First Amendment protect this kind of speech? Interesting question, and it's funny because this type of case has been litigated over and over the years. It's not the first time that we had this issue arise. Generally speaking, the First Amendment protects all speech, and the limits would be something that perhaps incites violence. Okay, so just because something is offensive, obviously, doesn't mean it violates the First Amendment, because we can say foul things, we can say things that are not nice and things that are vulgar, but that's not a crime. But if something incites violence, which generally has to do with taking an action other than expression. So let's just say that you're standing there and you swore, but you swore and at the same time you lunged and said, I'm going to hurt you with the swearing. That then could be altogether not just free speech, but it could be some sort of inciting violence. Or an assault even. Assault is a threatened battery, which means that the person feels as if they are in imminent harm of an attack. So that's when it goes over the line. Here, if it was simply just a finger being exposed, I would probably say that the ACLU is going to win this lawsuit because it is free speech to use that. It's not nice. It's not polite. It's not something you should do. But our First Amendment definitely covers that. It was interesting. I don't know if you all have all followed me, but I have been in Cambodia and Vietnam with my husband for Christmas, and I just read, and now it's interesting because I would never read anything about Cambodia because it had no relation to me, but having been in Cambodia, I saw a news item this week where the Cambodian government made it illegal to say anything negative at all about their king. Now, their king in Cambodia is not a very powerful man, and he is basically a figurehead, and he doesn't really do much there other than be head of the kingdom. The government is run by people who are supposedly elected, which they're really not elected. But I found it interesting because the crime was punishable by many years in jail and a lot of money. And I think that's the kind of thing we should all look at and say, and a lot of politicians don't like to be criticized, and there's lawsuits and defamation. But the bottom line is that we should be able to criticize our government, and we do it here, and we take it for granted, whereas many, many countries, including Vietnam, it's not acceptable. And it's not only not acceptable, but it's punishable. And in those countries, we don't even have civil rights, where you get a lawyer and you defend yourself and there's a constitution and you have a right to free speech. No, you basically go to jail or you disappear, which is what happens quite a bit. So going back to the silly case of the cop who gets flipped off, I think that it's an important case in that it stands for our rights here in this country, which are very, very, very important. I'm going to give out the numbers again. 312-981-7200. I'll be taking your legal calls around 8 o'clock on any legal topic. There was an interesting case that came down from Florida this week, Mount Dora, Florida. There was a homeowner who painted his house like the painting Starry, Starry Night. Have you seen it? It's that Vincent van Gogh. It's blue with stars and kind of fantastic kind of look. But he basically wanted to paint his house that way. Apparently, this is a town that has a very large art festival every year, and he painted it in time for this art festival. Well, the city came in and said, you can't do this. Yeah, this is against our zoning. The colors are ridiculous. We don't like it. And we are now going to fine you $100 a day until you repaint your house. I think they're up to about $8,000 in fines, and he is filing an appeal, and that appeal is going to be working its way through the courts. That's an interesting question. What right do you have to be a homeowner and to do what you want with your home? I think that the people who live in condos and apartment buildings know that there are usually a lot of rules when you live among people in a townhouse or a condo building, where you can only put up certain kinds of signs on your door, and you can't paint things the way you want them, and you can't put perhaps cameras outside your door. So there are a lot of rules when you have an apartment or a condo. But what if you have a freestanding house, a house that you've bought and that is sitting on a street? There are things called aesthetic zoning, which have been upheld by our U.S. Supreme Court. The court has said that our police power, which is the power delegated to the states that the federal government relinquishes to the states, basically, they can do what they want to protect the safety, the morality, and the welfare of the people. And the Supreme Court has said that coloring your house, painting your house, and having certain landscaping falls under that because it preserves the property values, and that if you let people do crazy things to their home, that would maybe drive down the value of the homes in the area. So interesting. It has caused a lot of litigation. It reminds me of a case that I litigated in California, where there was an area where it was very wealthy. A lot of celebrities lived there, and it was had an art jury. And the art jury that was in that subdivision made decisions as to whether or not a statue or a pond or landscaping was appropriate for the area. And my client decided to make his house the House of 10,000 Roses, and he planted 10,000 roses in beautiful terraces all along his property. It was beautiful. It smelled great. It was fantastic. The house was beautiful. And as soon as he finished it and spent all this money, the art jury said, "We don't like your roses because it doesn't go with the landscaping. This is more of a kind of a cowboy look with sort of a dusty, rocky look. And when you planted all these roses and put in this irrigation system to make sure that they were growing, this doesn't look like the rest of the houses, and we're going to have you tear it down." And of course, he got very angry, refused to do it, and he almost got thrown in jail. Very close to being thrown in jail for not taking down the roses. And he was held in contempt of court, and he was made to pay lots of fines and attorney's fees. And that goes to show you that before you move in, and if you have these kinds of issues, you should know what the restrictions are before you start planting roses and painting your house looking like a painting by Vincent van Gogh. Anyway, let's take a quick break, and this is the Karen Conti Show. Again, I'm going to give out the numbers because this is the time for legal questions, any question at all. If you don't know me and you haven't heard me on the Brian Noonan Show, I am a practicing lawyer. I've been a lawyer for over 30 years. I've practiced in many, many areas in law firms and in my own firm presently. I can talk about family law, criminal law. I can talk about estate planning a little bit. I can talk to you about almost anything and get you in the right direction. That number is 312-981-7200. And if for some reason you don't want to talk to me on air, it's something that's confidential or something that needs a little bit more detail, you can always call me at my office, which is 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. Back in a minute. You're listening to WGN.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law? Well, you see,
it's Karen Conti on the Karen Conti Show. This is the time now from 8 to 9 where I take all of your legal calls about any topic you might have that, you know, it's in the news or something that's personal to you or a friend of yours or something you've just been wondering about all of your life about the law. I will try my best to explain it in a way that is understandable and point you in the right direction. The numbers are 312-981-7200, or if you would prefer not to talk on the air, you can always text to that same number. All right, let's go to the first text. Congratulations on your show. Thank you, 708. Question about the homeowner with the roses. This is the rose garden that the guy put up in California. This sounds like a really extensive bit of landscaping. Was the homeowner informed at any time during the process that he couldn't do it? Not that it matters that the association didn't like it. It just seems like waiting was vindictive. Well, interesting, and this is actually Carol. Thank you, Carol, for the interesting call. That's very true. What happened in this case was they gave him some warnings that the art jury met every couple of months and that they should have that he should have submitted the plans and he didn't do it and that he was putting in these plants at his peril. And he, being kind of a brash guy, ignored that warning and continued to put it in, thinking once people saw how beautiful it was and how it smelled lovely and how wonderful it looked on the property and the terraced roses, that the art jury would say yes and would accept it. So he made a mistake, probably, if the truth be told, that he should have waited, submitted the plans, and gotten the approval before he spent the money. But that's a very, very good question. Let me go to another text, and you said, let's see, that there's something wrong with she lives in an apartment, and the ceiling is bubbling, and it's been 2 weeks. Rent is due on the 5th. Do I have the ability to withhold rent until they fix it? Generally speaking, you don't. Generally speaking, if it's something like that, that it's aesthetic, and no one likes to see bubbling on the ceiling, but that's not something that prevents you from living there and enjoying the property. So you really don't have legal right to withhold rent. But I think you should send letters. I think you should make it clear that this is affecting what you're doing and living there, and see if you can push them in the right direction. If the problem were something like a big flood, or there was no heat, or there was something that made the place completely unlivable, black mold, where you're getting sick, then I could see that you would have a legal right to withhold the rent until they fixed it. And even then, what I tend to advise people is perhaps you put it into some sort of account and you're paying the rent's there, but you're holding it until the situation is resolved itself. But the bottom line is you're going to want to read your contract. You want to read your lease. And the lease is a pretty standard form, but a lot of people are afraid to read their lease because they think it's legalese, and a lot of it is, but this should be spelled out in your lease exactly what your rights are when there are these kinds of issues. Let's go to any other calls, 981-7200 or text 981-7200. This is coming from the 847. I'm a bit nervous about speaking live, so I'd like to ask my question via text. I'm looking to get divorced from my husband after 25 years. I'm assuming that everything will be divided 50-50. However, I heard that some women get more than that. Is this true? Just so you know, I've been a stay-at-home wife for the past 12 years. Okay, so in a divorce, basically, we have issues of property and we have issues of maintenance, which is formerly known as alimony. And if you're a stay-at-home wife, you may be entitled to support from your husband for a period of time. In a 25-year marriage, that's a long period of time. So you could be entitled to some significant maintenance from your spouse. But the issue of property division, generally speaking, we start with the idea that everything acquired during the course of the marriage is what we call marital property. And it pictures like a barrel. So maybe you had some stuff before your marriage that's outside the barrel, but during the course of the marriage, everything that you earned goes into that barrel, whether the husband earned it or whether the wife earned it. And people say, well, this is my 401k and this is my pension. Well, if it was earned during the marriage, it does belong to both parties. And when it's in that barrel, at the end of a marriage, the court will do what's equitable and will divide it up. Generally, it's 50-50. You start with that concept that 50-50 is fair, because if husband is off working and wife is taking care of children and raising them and is foregoing her, basically her livelihood in order to raise children, those two contributions are deemed to be equal under the law, meaning just because the guy went out and earned the paycheck doesn't mean that the wife doesn't get the benefit of the property that has been acquired during the course of the marriage. So the only time where you might see a 60-40 split or maybe even more is, let's just say that you're a stay-at-home mom, you're not earning any money, and the court may say that I'm going to give you a little bit more of the marital estate to make up for the fact that you're not going to have ongoing income like the husband is. So in those cases, sometimes the judge will give you more than 50-50. The other situation is, let's just say that the wife has $2 million of inheritance money that came in. Now, it came in during the marriage, but it always stayed in her name, and it was a gift to her from a family member. That would mean that that's non-marital, not in that barrel. The court could say, because the wife has all of this extra money outside the marriage, she's in a better position to take care of herself in older years, so I'm going to give the husband a little bit more, because that makes it fair when it comes to them both taking care of themselves at the end of the day. So those are some of the factors that the courts will consider, and if you want to talk to me further about it, I'm happy to talk at the office about that, and I can send you an article that spells out some of these things so you can read it and understand it better. My number is 312-332-7800 or WGN at AskKarenConti.com. But we're taking your calls now. Again, I'm going to give out the number, 312-981-7200. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. How are you?
Okay.
What is your question?
This is Lynn. Is that who you want?
Oh, yes, it's Lynn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I just was wondering if there's any way to change your power of attorney.
Okay. Your power of attorney for, is this for your health care decisions or for your financial decisions?
Well, I guess both.
Okay. Yes, you can. Absolutely. Did you fill out one of those forms that and had it notarized and all that?
No, I didn't do anything.
Okay. Okay. So do you have a power of attorney currently?
It's not. I don't, but my husband does.
Okay, and he wants to change it?
I want to change it.
Okay, you want to change it for him or he? I'm not understanding.
No, hon. I just would like to get it back.
So he drafted a power of attorney, and you're not the person making the decisions.
I think the court gave him that, maybe.
Okay.
You see, he's taking my pension, and I inherited some money, and I can't get it back, so.
Okay. This is all kind of confused to me. You're still married to him, correct?
Yeah, yes.
And he, who's got the pension? He's got the pension?
Well, he's taking it.
He's taking it, and he's not sharing it with you? Is that the problem?
Yes.
Okay. So these are very difficult things to handle while you're married. Unfortunately, you may not be able to do anything about this unless you file for divorce. I'm not encouraging you to file for divorce because I don't do that. It's not my decision.
No, but, I know.
But you can't really force him not to take the money, just as he can't force you not to spend money. There's no way to do that legally unless you have a divorce on file. So,
okay, well, I can't spend money if I don't have it.
Yeah.
See, that's the problem. I do have money, but it's not accessible to me.
Okay. All right. You can't change his power of attorney. The only person who can do that is the individual. And even though you're married to him, you don't have the right to do that.
Okay.
So that's the bottom line. It seems to me that you probably could use like an hour with an attorney talking to them about estate plan, about divorce, about your future, about your inheritance money and how to protect that from him, let me give you my contact information and you can call me at the office and I can give you a referral to someone if it's not myself. Okay?
No, you've given me enough information.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Lynn. All right. Take care. All right. You're listening to Karen Conti Show on WGN. I'm going to give you numbers. We've got lots of lines open here, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. The time where I answer your legal questions here, 312-981-7200. You don't have to use your real name. You can use an alias if you want, and you can tell me that it's your best friend's cousin's sister-in-law if you want. Let us go to Richard. Richard, welcome to the show. How are you?
Doing good.
Good. What's your question?
I was wondering about those loss of interest officers at Walmart. How far can they go? I mean, do you have any rights when you're in your store?
Tell me what your issue is. You're saying the security guards?
Well, they follow me around. I had them follow me to the bathroom. I've had them follow me around and harassing me. And I've never done anything in the store, so I don't understand. You know, I'm trying to figure out how I get them to stop.
How many times did this happen to you?
They go on for a while. They target me for some reason, but I don't know why. I've been targeted, and I don't know why.
Okay. And, you know, this is... Just, I know a little bit about how security works, and I'm going to put you on hold and talk a little bit about it. Sometimes the security guards they have obviously cameras throughout the store, and the security guards will watch people, and they do target people. I know that sometimes people start acting a little strange. I had a client once who was a woman, and she was shopping for a purse, and she actually took her stuff out of her purse and put stuff in the purse to see if it would fit. That's what women do, to see if their stuff will fit in the purse. And she was targeted, and they followed her around, and they harassed her, and all kinds of it was very uncomfortable for her, and they actually stopped her, and they accused her, and they wanted to look through her stroller. But that's what they do. They target people. Now, do they target people based on race? Do they target people based upon what they're wearing? Maybe. You know, and but the bottom line is, what can you do about that? And the answer is probably nothing, because hiring a lawyer at $300 an hour to sue Walmart over some bad security experience, I would say, is not a good use of your money. If you wanted to do something about it, the best thing to do would be to write a letter and to put something on the website and say, this is what happened to me. I hope that it would never happen again. I would write to the management, the local management at the store there. I would also maybe write to, you know, one of the national store. If you are being targeted and you think you're being untargeted unfairly, you probably aren't the only one. And maybe they would put a stop to this abuse. And I have to say, they could be just doing their jobs, and it could be that you're a little sensitive because they're being invasive with you. But again, I don't know the whole situation. All I know is that the court system and lawyers are not the way to go when it comes to trying to resolve that. Thank you for the call. Kristen, welcome to WGN. It's the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I live in a townhome complex, and I have a three-month-old baby. We moved in about a month before I had the baby, and we've had nothing but issues with our neighbors right next to us. Very loud music, a lot of smoke that somehow comes in and comes through our ventilation system all over our house. We've kind of overlooked all of that because we didn't want to make trouble, but recently there's been an enormous amount of marijuana being smoked and circulating through our home to the point where we've had to take our baby and leave because we've been affected by the marijuana.
Oh.
Our landlord is trying to kick them out. He's having some legal difficulties with it, so I'm just wondering what our rights are. My husband wants to leave, and I just went back to work and have a three-month-old, so I would prefer not to move my whole life at this moment.
Okay, there's a lot of stuff going on here, Kristen. This is a terrible situation. I understand you're kind of stuck there. But as long as your landlord's doing something, I suppose that's good. The problem is that evicting people is not as easy as you think. You would think you could just send a notice and then they're out the next day. No, you've got to give a certain number of days notice, and then if they want to go to court and fight it, they can try to do that. The other option you have, I'm sure you thought about it, is to call the police. Have you done that or thought about doing that?
Yes. The police came over a couple weeks ago when it was very bad, and there happened to be a lot of noise at the same time. The police were in the house, and their comment was, man, it really smells like pot in here, and that was it. So we were kind of like, huh? Like, that's it?
You know, some of this, you know, if I told you to leave, could the landlord sue you for the rest of the lease money? Yes. Will the landlord do that? Probably not. If you've decided that you are going to take that risk, here's how I would do it. I would give, and I'm not talking about oral notice, I'm talking about written notice. This confirms that this problem started in September. I've been talking about this problem. This is the loudness. This is the marijuana. We've tried to resolve this. I can't do this. I have a baby. It's injurious to his health. And I'm giving you notice that I'm going to be leaving within 30 days. Please take all efforts to lease the property to somebody else, because that then puts them on notice that you're leaving. And then that landlord has an obligation to find somebody else immediately. That doesn't mean that he can't sue you, and that doesn't mean that he maybe wouldn't win. But if I were you, I would opt for being healthy and safe and and leaving taking the high road and hoping that perhaps the landlord is going to understand that what you did was the right thing. Maybe not from a legal standpoint, but from a family standpoint. Go ahead.
Is there any way that we would be able to get in that situation, like our security deposit back, or at least a month of rent or something, or is that kind of a long shot?
That's a long shot. He would have to do that voluntarily, Kristen, and he probably won't do it. He'd probably hold on to your security deposit, and you would just walk away with the hopes that he didn't sue you for the remaining balance of the rent. Good luck. It's a really bad problem. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Pat. Hi, Pat. Welcome to WGN.
Hey, welcome, Karen. How are you?
Good, good. What's your legal question?
So if the police came to my house looking for my neighbor, and after they left, if I called the neighbor to let him know that the police were looking for him, would I have any legal issues with that?
No. No, not at all. I don't see anything that would be wrong for you doing that. I mean, it's not like you're, you know, let's just say that he was a criminal and you knew he robbed a bank and you were harboring a criminal and you told the police that you didn't know where he was and you did, and then you said, hey, the police are looking, you better leave. That would be some kind of, maybe, you know, some kind of accessory or harboring a criminal or something like that. But what you're telling me is cops are looking for you. There's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, good.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Pat. Let's take one last quick one. I'm going to give out the numbers again because on the other side of the half an hour, we're going to be continuing to take legal calls, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Judy. Judy, I only have a few minutes, but I want to get to you. What is your legal question?
Okay, I love your new show. You did great your first time last week.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I am hoarse. I'm taking a break from the Super Bowl.
Okay.
You were talking about shoplifting a few minutes ago. To my knowledge, they cannot accost you while you are in the store. They can only do it once you step out of the store without paying for a product.
Well, I mean, that's not to say that they can't confront you in the store. I mean, I don't know that there's any rule or law about that, but what you're saying is it's not shoplifting until someone takes it out of the store. And that's
exactly
true. And that's true. And
exactly.
That's why they have cameras right at the cusp there, when you step out into the sidewalk or the mall, because that's when you have to have the intention to take something and then you actually have to take it. So
that
doesn't mean that a security guy couldn't walk and say something to someone or even follow them around. I just don't know any laws that preclude that. Is that harassing? Yes, but again, there's no cause of action, and how are you going to pay a lawyer $5,000 to tell someone not to follow you around to Walmart? That just doesn't make any sense. But thank you for the call, and that you are right about that. Thank you so much, Judy. Go back to the Super Bowl and have some fun. Okay. Okay, I'll take one more call. Let's go to Barbara. Hey, Barbara. Welcome to WGN.
Thanks, Karen. I just have a real quick question because I know you got to go to break for news.
Yes.
I'm a divorced single mom. And our divorce agreement was any medical expenses or doctor visits or glasses, whatever, if it wasn't covered under insurance, we would split the cost 50-50.
Yes.
I am still waiting for the funds from 2016 and the first half of 2017. Is there anything I can do to get my funds?
Okay, so here's what you do. You're keeping track of all of this, and you're keeping track of the fact that you gave him all of those receipts, correct?
Absolutely correct.
The problem is going back to court for what might amount to, how much is it right now?
At this point, it's about $500.
Okay.
I haven't given him the second half of 2017 yet.
Okay, my best advice to you before we go to break is that you keep the track of that, really keep good track of it. And it's not worth it to go to court and get a lawyer and spend that money to get $500. But
right.
Later, when you go back for college expenses or you have some other issues like child support needs to be renegotiated, then you save that issue for when you go back to court. But I would continue to be on him for it and send those emails and make sure that he knows that you have proof of the fact that you've sent those to him. Good luck.
Okay,
and thank you. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
You're listening to WGN.
In 10 years, we're going to have 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers. In 10 years, we're going to have 1 million lawyers. How much can the poor nations to everybody now? In 10 years.
This is the time to call. I'm taking all your legal questions on any topic that you might have. I'll help you out, try to send you in the right direction or give you an answer. 312-981-7200, 981-7200, and if you'd like to text, you can text there as well. If you don't get in your call tonight, you can call me at the office, which is 312-332-7800, or email me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com. We have a texter who said, how much does it cost to have a will prepared in Illinois? That's a hard question to answer directly because it all depends on how complicated your estate is. If there are a lot of assets, if there are different kinds of assets that need to be taken care of in different ways, it gets more expensive. And also it depends where you are. Central Illinois, very inexpensive. You could probably have an estate plan done, I would imagine, a simple one for about $1,500. In Chicago, what I see as standard is about $2,500, which takes care of all of the issues like powers of attorney so that if you become disabled during your life, you can have someone help you out with medical decisions and financial decisions, and also a trust that would put everything into a situation where you don't have to go through probate, meaning it doesn't have to go to court, and it's much easier and less expensive. So that's what I'm seeing, generally speaking, but again, it's going to vary depending upon the area and depending upon the complication and the amount of your estate. I had an interesting question. We were talking about medical marijuana the other day on the show, and someone asked the question of what happens if you have a medical marijuana card, do you disclose that on an employment application in regards to drug testing? You know, I've never faced that issue, but my best legal guess would be that you don't disclose it in an application because that is a medical condition, and medical conditions are not something that an employer can use to hire you necessarily. So you keep that quiet, you get your job, but then when there's drug testing, you need to be able to tell the person who's testing you that you have a medical marijuana card, and I would bring it there, and you'd have to show that you have it. Obviously, you've gone through the hoops to get it, so there is a medical necessity in Illinois to get one. And so, therefore, if you turn positive for marijuana, I would imagine they would note that, but they probably would also note that you are legally able to take it. So that's probably the way I would handle it. Again, let me give out the numbers, 312-981-7200. I'm going to go to a couple of questions that I got this week. Well, I got a call from a woman in Glen Ellen, and she asked me, when hiring a lawyer, is it necessary that the lawyer have offices in the county where the case is filed? And that's a good question. And the answer is no. But let's just say that you have a divorce and it was filed in DuPage County, which I think would be Glen Ellen. Would you want an attorney from Chicago or would you want an attorney from DuPage? There's reasons why you would hire an attorney from Chicago. Perhaps you have a connection with somebody, you have somebody who it comes on very good recommendations, and someone you want to retain, and that person practices in DuPage County, and that's fine. If you'd prefer to have someone closer to the courthouse, maybe someone who is there more often and has more connections there, then you could hire someone from DuPage County. The question that you should be asking the lawyer is, if you have to travel to a Collar County, so if you're in Will County and you hire a Chicago attorney, is that attorney charging for travel time? Because that is something you need to factor in to the equation. Whether, you know, a court appearance that's a one-hour court appearance could turn into a three-hour court appearance because of the travel time. So that's something that you're going to want to make sure before you agree to have a lawyer represent you. Another question that I got a couple of weeks ago. I am divorced. My younger daughter started college in the fall, and I co-signed on a student loan. My ex is refusing to contribute to her tuition and room and board. Can I make him pay going forward, and can I get him to repay me when I start to have to repay the loan? So this is an issue of contribution to college expenses. And generally speaking, those issues don't get decided by a judge until the issues arise. So let's just say parties are getting divorced. I get people divorced all the time, and their kids are 5 years old, and they want to provide for college. Well, the judge won't really allow that to happen because it's not really something that can be decided until you get right on the cusp of the child going to school. And much is going to depend. Where does the child get into school? Where does the child want to go to school? What are you making and what is your spouse making? What are your financial situations? Maybe you inherited money in between that time the child was young and the child's going to college. So you you're going to have to wait until the time comes to have that decided by the judge. Hopefully, you and your spouse can ex-spouse can agree upon how it's going to be divided. You're going to probably want to ask the child where the child wants to go and have some input in that. But the issue is that the courts will look at the ability of both parties to pay and to contribute. And generally speaking, judges will require parents to pay. Even if you don't believe that it's correct to have to pay for your children's college, and I know some parents think that tough love is the good thing and that no one paid for my college and therefore I don't want to pay, the judge will probably make you pay. So just know that as you go down the line that you may have to take out loans, you may have to liquidate assets, you may have to even take a mortgage on your house to put your kid through college. However, you are limited in your outstanding liability by what it cost to go to U of I. So let's just say this year the total cost for U of I is about $33,000 when it comes to tuition and room and board. That's the most that the judge will make both parties pay collectively. So sometimes judges will say half and half. Sometimes judges will say a third for one parent, a third for another parent, and the child has to take out a loan for the rest of the money. It all depends on the judge, and it depends on your financial situation. Now, in this case, she says that she took out a loan. She co-signed for the loan. Generally speaking, you have to have these issues resolved when they are happening. So the fact that you already did that, maybe a judge might say, well, you should have filed for contribution before this happened. And therefore, because you signed it without a court order, you might be on the line to pay that back with your child. As to future semesters, the judge would probably then look at the needs of the parties and the needs of the child and the ability of the parties to pay and decide at that juncture who pays going forward. So a little bit of advice. Generally speaking, you should be thinking about making those arrangements to pay for college well before your kid starts. So if application process is starting in fall, you should be talking to your ex-spouse, coming up with a plan and an agreement on how you're going to pay it. And in the absence of such an agreement, you're going to need to file and go to court to get such contribution. Even though most people don't want to go back to court, that might be the only way. The number here is 312-981-7200. Let's go to what tips do you have for the reservist and National Guard personnel going through a divorce? Ooh, this is hard, and I assume that what we're talking about is someone who's got maybe weekends that they have to be in the reserve. I know how that goes, and people who are deployed. This is very difficult because it's hard to litigate this kind of stuff when you're away, and you need to get a lawyer who's going to be aggressive and make sure your rights are taken care of. When it comes to parenting time, we don't call it visitation anymore, we call it parenting time, the reservist may know what the schedule is a month before and may know that you have a second weekend that you might have to serve occasionally, and that changes. So your ex is going to have to be flexible when it comes to weekend parenting time because you may not know ahead of time when you are going to be available to take care of your children. As to the issue of child support and all that, it shouldn't affect it because you are going to be paying a certain amount of child support based upon what you earn and based upon what your spouse earns. So that really is not going to be affected by your duty. But I have found that the judges are very, very, very well willing to be flexible to parents who have these obligations because, number one, you're serving your country, you're doing something good, you have no control over your schedule, and children need to see their parents, both parents. And it's important that the non-reserve parent has some flexibility and allows for some change in plans. Now, if a child has plans in sports and things like that, it's hard to have the child change those plans to accommodate your Army schedule or your military schedule. But generally speaking, the courts are very good in doing that. Sometimes mediation is helpful, too, to see if you can resolve things outside the court process. But that's a very good question. We're going to take a break now, and we've got 15 more minutes to answer your legal questions. I see they're coming in, and I'm going to see if I can get to all of them tonight. Again, the number's here, 312-981-7200, or text to 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN AM 720. It's the Karen Conti Show. Just a few minutes left to get your legal calls in, 312-981-7200. Before I go to the calls, and they're coming in, I wanted to tell you there is an organization called Ladder Up, like a ladder, L-A-D-D-E-R, and they are volunteers who are available to help you with your taxes. If your income is between $30,000 and $55,000 a year, look up Ladder Up, and they have different sites throughout the city, and they have free volunteers who will help you with your tax returns. They're a great organization, and you could go to goladderup.org, and they have telephone numbers for all of the times and the dates where they'll be available, and I thought you would like to know that. Let's go to Karen. What a great name. Karen, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. What's your legal question?
I was wondering about the difference between a will and a trust, and which one is better, or is there neither one that's better?
I can talk generally about this. I'm not an estate planning lawyer, but generally speaking, what you want is a trust for the most part, unless you have an estate that's a certain size, because a trust doesn't go through the court system, okay, and it avoids the process of going through court. That's the general reason that you would have a trust. And normally, when you have a trust, you also have a will, which really just takes care of the things that maybe didn't get put into the trust properly. So it's sort of a fail-safe for what you didn't put into the trust. So a trust, again, is like you put everything in it, all of your assets, all of your bank accounts, all of those things, and then when you pass, that trust decides how it's going to be dispersed. It's going to go to the heirs, it's going to pay off debts, it's going to do all kinds of things, and the executor of that trust takes those actions. And that's a good thing because you don't have to involve the judge and lawyers and things like that. The will is really, like I said, just sort of a fail-safe in case for some reason all of the assets were not put into the trust. But there's all kinds of whistles and bells, and I'm probably just using a very broad brush there, but there's not, it's not like you say, I need one or the other, because generally you probably will have two, unless there's something very simple about your estate that can be handled that way. I hope that answered
okay.
your question, Karen. All right, take care. Thank you for the call.
Right.
Let's go to Jim. Jim has a traffic court question. Whoa, it's been a while since I've practiced there, but let me see if I can help you. What's your question, Jim?
I rear-ended a FedEx truck that was parked in the sun on my lane instead of in the shade in the driveway, and I was just wondering when I go to court for the two tickets for not having insurance and for a failure to reduce speed to avoid an accident. Should I plead guilty or not guilty?
I really can't tell you that exactly, but there are different options. And usually when you go to traffic court, the judge will tell you what your options are. First thing to do is bring your proof of insurance, okay? Definitely bring your proof of insurance. That's the first thing the judge is going to ask for. And then you could plead to what they call supervision, which means that if you go, it's not really guilty or not guilty, but what it does is if you go for a certain number of months without anything on your record, then it disappears, okay? And you may have to go to driving school, which costs a little bit of money, but then it doesn't go against you on your record. That's sometimes an option. As I sit here, not seeing the tickets, not knowing your whole history, not knowing what if you've had other moving violations, I can't give you specific advice. If you need a traffic lawyer, which some people will hire a traffic lawyer to go to court for them if it's important, to make sure that this gets done right, I can refer you to somebody who can handle that. Hope that answers your question, Jim. All right?
Thank you.
Take care. Let's go to Sandra. Sandra, welcome to Karen Conti Show on WGN. What's your legal question?
Well, I asked before if I could change my power of attorney to someone else, and I'm just wondering if the only way to do that is to get a divorce, which is expensive.
Okay. Are you telling me, because I was confused the first time, does your husband have control over your assets because he has your power of attorney?
Yes.
Okay. And was that power of attorney done by a court, or was that signed by you?
It was not signed by me.
Okay.
First of all,
you know what, Sandra, you're going to have to talk to me off air on this because something's not making sense here. All right. I'm trying to help you. You're telling me.
I know, but what does not make sense?
What doesn't make sense is you have a power of attorney which you had to have signed, and you're telling me you didn't sign it. So I don't know why there's a power of attorney in his favor. Okay. All right. I don't understand that. Sandra, if you want to talk to me at the office, I'm happy to talk to you. I know that you're frustrated, but I'm frustrated too because I don't understand your question. Call me at 312-332-7800. Texter from the 253 area code, which I don't know where that is. What are normal attorney fees for representation in family law cases in Cook County? How is that important for people considering a divorce and working with the other party to work out a deal? Attorney's fees and the amount of attorney's fees and the rate, the hourly rate of attorney's fees is very important in making a decision on who to hire. The lawyers in Chicago sometimes charge more than some of the lawyers, say, in Central Illinois or Will County. That's just the way it works. It's a very important consideration. It should be one of the first questions you ask your attorney. On the other hand, it's important to get a good quality attorney because I've seen this over and over again. There are lawyers out there who charge very little by the hour, but they don't take care of their cases. They don't return phone calls. They stretch things out. They don't show up in court, and things fall between the cracks. And then the case gets stretched out, and it becomes more expensive in the long run rather than cheaper. So attorney's fees are important, but it's not like you look at the blue jeans and you say they're the same pair of blue jeans. One has the designer brand, and I don't want to pay the money for the designer brand. I get that. That makes sense. But with attorneys, you are going to need to factor that in to a whole lot of other factors, including the person's experience, who else in their office is going to work on the case, are they familiar with the area of law, is this what they practice? Are they good at what they do? Are they aggressive? Do they move things along? All of those things are probably a little bit more than, say, a difference between $25 or $50 an hour. But thank you for the call. Again, let me give out the numbers, 312-981-7200. Let's see. I've got some comments about the lady who was calling, and I feel bad for the lady who was calling, but I didn't mean to be picky about it, but I didn't quite understand exactly what her situation was. I have a question that came in this week. It says, I own a small business, and I received what I think is a subpoena ordering me to come to court. Do I need a lawyer? And I answered a question like this just recently, but generally speaking, if you receive a subpoena and it tells you that you need to do something like go to court, or it tells you that you need to produce documents to the court, you need to honor it, and you need to honor it by the time that's on that subpoena. If for some reason you can't honor it, you should call up the person or the entity who sent you that subpoena and explain to them why you can't do what they ask you to do. Otherwise, you will need to, if you feel like you don't want to honor it for some reason, you're going to have to hire a lawyer to go to court and move to what we call quash the subpoena, which means to void the subpoena so you don't have those obligations. But short of that, you're going to have to comply with that. It's a very standard thing that happens when, let's say, there's a car accident and you might be a witness to that car accident and someone subpoenas you to court to testify about what happened. That's something that that you're going to have to comply with, and that's a very common one. If you're a business owner, a lot of times in a divorce, maybe one of the parties wants to get the information from about an employee from your job, and you're going to have to produce payroll records and the like. So that's something that that is, yes, you have to honor it, and you must do that. And frankly, if you don't honor it, you can be held in contempt of court. So it's very, very important to have that happen. Let's see, one more. Let's see, my daughter works as a teacher in an unsafe neighborhood. What duty does the employer have to make sure she gets to her car after work? Generally speaking, your employer does have an obligation to make sure you get to the to get to your car, and if, especially if there have been other incidents involving unsavory characters, they do have an obligation to make sure that you're safe. But your daughter needs to take matters into her own hands and definitely work with the employer to make sure that she gets what she needs.